CliffCentral.com. Okay, this is the Gareth Cliff Show. It is Thursday the 9th of September. I had to think about that for 2 seconds.
It's the 6th, so you should have thought for a few more seconds. Sia.
I was trying to say it's the 9th month, you know. I was just, just making sure that you have the dates right.
Yeah, okay. There's a quick comeback.
It's the 6th of September, there you go, 2018. Thursday, so the second hour of the show, you know that we focus on the burning platform where we catch up with some intriguing people who have their eyes and their ears to the ground. Well, their eyes on the news.
And their ears to the ground.
Their ears to the ground and their finger on the pulse.
See, oh, what look there. At that. Mm. All the body parts.
All the body parts making use of it. And they're doing great things about it. And so this morning we're chatting to none other than a legal journalist and also writer for various publications. I'm so grateful that she made some time for us this morning. Good morning, Karen Morn.
Hello.
Thank you so much for chatting to us this morning. There has been so much that's happening in politics and in terms of South African leaders for the past week.
Yeah, I mean, the state capture inquiry is obviously something that's been long awaited for quite some time. So that's playing itself out. We're back in today for the Gupta's lawyers to apply for them to cross-examine a number of witnesses based on the premise that if they asked to testify, Ajay Gupta wants to do it via video link in Dubai. And then obviously they continue with the cross-examination of Pumla Williams. But the fascinating aspect of all of this is that the former president, who for so long was, you know, basically hinting that he had all these truths that he wanted to spill and would give his side of the story of state capture, has not applied to make an application to cross-examine, leading many people to believe that he may want to try and avoid the prospect of himself being given, you know, giving testimony, even though he can be subpoenaed.
Can we break all of this down to begin with? Because I'm fascinated by this entire process. This is my first time really, I think, in the country we've seen anything like this at this level. So, for example, with the Guptas, is it something that will stand, the fact that they will only be cross-examined if it's through video link?
Look, I think that the Deputy Chief Justice is very conscious of the fact that the allegations against them are so serious that if this is how they are prepared to give evidence, then that might be what they have to do. I think they're between a bit of a rock and a hard place, because Ajay Gupta's issue is that the Hawks have branded him a fugitive from justice, but they don't want to tell him exactly what he's wanted for. We very much, you know, my understanding is it's in connection with the Kabisi Jonas allegations of corruption and trying to bribe him to become finance minister. But he's basically saying he has quote unquote mistrust for the NPA and the Hawks, and he doesn't want to return to the country not knowing exactly what's going on. And I think in the initial phases of the whole arrest with Estina, there was massive confusion. At one stage, I think the Hawks confused RJ with Atul and said he was a suspect in Estina, when in fact, I think the then police minister said that, when in fact he wasn't. So there is a lot of confusion. But take that out of the mix, take the Hawks dynamic out of the mix. If they don't give the Guptas the opportunity to put their side of the story in some kind of evidence on paper, whatever it is, and face cross-examination, then, you know, all those people that are saying that, oh, this is just a whitewash, you're not really interested, you just want to, like, lambaste the Guptas and Zuma and make them the scapegoats, inverted commas, those people are going to have a bit of a leg to stand on, because you haven't even heard their side of the story. As dodgy as that side of the story may be, I think I would be quite surprised if Zondo says, no, if you're not prepared to come back to the country, I'm not going to hear your evidence. I'd be quite surprised if he did that, because it means that whole aspect of what their response to these claims is off the table. And then immediately, under the rules of ulti alteram partem, hear all sides, you haven't heard their side of the story, and the findings that you make will inevitably in some form be legally compromised.
I guess this really does speak to what a fair process something like this should be, because it's hard for us who are just seeing this from the outside, and of course we carry our own emotions. It's hard for us not to be subjective and say, no, we want him here. We want him to feel the wrath of how angry we are, and we want him to be exposed for who he is and who his family is as well.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. I think one of the difficulties is that I know that the inquiry has said to the Hawks, please tell us what cases are these people wanted for. And they have been meetings, and the Hawks at this point are not prepared to disclose that information. So the inquiry itself doesn't really know. I mean, the Hawks are saying RJ is a fugitive, but they don't want to say what case it is. And there are all these allegations with regards to the Hawks' handling of these various state capture cases. So it's a bit of a mess. And I do understand why people would think, well, you know, stuff them, unless they're prepared to come back into the country and themselves sit in that dock and face cross-examination, then we're not prepared to listen to them. But I think that I would suspect that Zondo will be a bit more pragmatic and say, well, we'll allow this evidence in, we'll put it to the witnesses, and then in the interest of fairness, because if he doesn't, you know, we could have a situation where they finalize this report and it's immediately challenged in court, and you go and say, well, we try to give our side of the story, and they don't want to hear us, so with this report can't stand, and then it's locked in, you know, legal tussles. And I think the main thing is to just try as much as you can in these very difficult circumstances to at least attempt to get their response in some form or another to these allegations.
Do we understand or know on what grounds the Hawks doesn't want to disclose information, or why they're doing that?
Well, I have spoken to them, and they've just said, look, on record, they've said we're cooperating fully with the inquiry. I know they had a meeting with them last week, Monday, but off record, they've sort of said, listen, these guys want us to disclose our dockets to them. We have multiple cases involving the Guptas, and we know the Hawks have confirmed that they're investigating a criminal case against both the former president and Ajay Gupta in relation to Themba Maseko's allegations. So it's not just the Jonas matter, it's other cases. And they're saying, we don't want to go and, if we go and disclose, then the Guptas are going to know what we're doing, and we don't want that to happen. Mm. I think one of the other difficulties, to be honest with you, is that it came out in the evidence of Jonas himself that he wasn't 100% sure which Gupta brother had actually made this alleged bribe/threat to him. It could have been Ajay, it could have been Rajesh. So that certainly puts the whole criminal case in jeopardy, because if you can't establish the identity of the person that he was talking to, you certainly can't prosecute at this point. And we know that Dudazane Zuma, the former president's son, is facing charges in relation to the Jonas matter. So I think the Hawks are between in a rock and a hard place, because I don't think they want to necessarily disclose that they wanted RJ for that case, given that there are now these legal difficulties around the identity of who exactly Jonas spoke to on his version.
How much do you think we're going to find out when former Minister Lynn Brown now gets to speak out, because she's one who's applied to cross-examine Jonas and said that one of the Gupta brothers told him to the family to look after her?
Yeah, I mean, that's, she obviously wants to dispute that. I mean, it's basically hearsay evidence, because Jonas is saying that this Gupta brother, whether it was Ajay or Rajesh, said this to her. She has been at the center of a lot of allegations that, you know, she was a pivotal player in state capture, and she's always denied that. She, remember in the ESCOM inquiry, she very much came out strongly to bat and said that this was unfair and what have you. I suspect she will actually even be required, potentially summoned or potentially volunteer to give evidence in this inquiry to deal, you know, with these kind of allegations, because she's repeatedly said that she's, you know, she wasn't used as a mechanism, or she wasn't a knowing player in the state capture narrative. But unfortunately, you know, as with Malusi Gigaba as well, certain things happened under both of their watches in their positions that I think they're going to have to explain and try and, because ultimately the buck stops with them. Whether they, you know, whether there were things going wrong behind their backs or whatever, they need to explain their side of the story and put that on record. And I think she will. I think she's very, very much likely to actually come and give evidence herself.
You interestingly use the term, the buck stops with them, and that leads to accountability. And I think I speak for a lot of people when we say we're hoping in this process we do get a sense of people owning up to what they've done. Definitely for us, we'd like to hear the honest accounts of what has happened. Do you think we will get a sense of accountability and conclusion to a lot of the stories that we've heard over the past little while?
You know,
she says with a sigh of relief. Oh no.
No, it's just, you know, the problem is that I think what happened was that people who did speak out, and this was the piece that I wrote in Business Day yesterday, was people who did speak out basically got vilified. Like someone like Themba Maseko, who was a DG, just got, you know, basically in many respects forced out of government. You know, it came at huge cost to them. And I think for those individuals, there were a whole sea of other officials around them that witnessed this and realized that not going along with what the Guptas, you know, with what the, you know, Guptas allegedly wanted, or this alleged state capture project, could really be problematic for their continued careers. People have families, people have, you know, they need their jobs. And I think a lot of people who would see themselves as being good, inverted commas, people, went along with things that were very problematic. And I think that phenomena didn't just happen with state capture. I think it happens in the corporate sphere. I think that we as a country treat people who come forward and identify issues within organizations, be they corporate or government, they get treated horrifically. And I mean, any human being will look at this. I think a lot of people in that situation may have looked at what happened and thought, you know, I've got a family, I need to keep my job. And those people now, I think, you know, are keeping silent because they were complicit in what happened. Maybe not in a deliberate or you know, wanting to be part of that. But they are now afraid to come forward because they also then face the attack of, but why did you do nothing? You know, why were you complicit in this? And what's so fascinating is that we've seen Zondo come out and say, you know, he was actually quite disappointed, was the word he used, with the lack of people who've come forward. Mm. He said, you know, and he even said this to Maseko with those DGEs who signed that memorandum. He said, you think these people are going to come forward? And you know, they have chosen not to at this point. And I think part of the problem there is also that if you are someone who went along with it and now puts up your hand and says, well, I want to explain what happened, you know, our environment is such that you know you are going to be torn apart within public discourse, because South Africans, I would argue, are extremely unforgiving. And it, you know, it's a massive risk to say, come out and say, yes, I was part of this, but I'm sorry. We don't have that kind of culture. And that is what's going to stymie this commission in some respects, because if we want to get to the heart of what happened, we need people who were in the machinery of this thing, who were wittingly or unwittingly part of it, to come forward and say, this is what I did, this is what I know. You know, and I think that's a real difficulty. And I think we as a society need to evaluate how easy we make it for people to come out and tell the truth.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we do make it very easy for them.
But I do have to commend you and say that your article in the Business Day yesterday was so pertinent, because you titled it "The Shocking Testimony, Evidence of the Pain Whistleblowers Endure." And I'm not trying to condone what these people have done. I'm not trying to defend them, but you know, if I was also in their position and I'm saying, well, another one is dropping and another one is being, you know, this is what is happening to that one, I would also have that trepidation of, oof, I don't know if I want to go on with this.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, all of us work in have worked in workplaces or experienced things where, you know, we might be, you know, whether it's in a labor environment or in a company environment, I mean, things may happen and we feel profoundly uncomfortable with things or decisions in our environment. And, you know, as a human being, to be confronted with that decision of, do I rock the boat and potentially jeopardize my career prospects, everything become, you know, potentially targeted? Or do I just remain quiet because I fear the repercussions? You know, all of us at one stage or another, if we haven't had it already, we'll have an experience like that. And I think we really, you know, it's easy to cast judgment when you're not the one in that situation. And I think it also leads us to really respect and show admiration for the people who have had the bravery of coming forward,
yeah,
despite all of this. And I just think, you know, my point is this: we all like, oh, these guys must go to jail, people must be prosecuted. But we're not a society that rewards integrity. We don't go and say, wow, this person came out and spoke the truth. Like, you know, let's really do everything we can to support and protect and reward this person for acting in an honest way. We don't do that. Themba Maseko, you know, he said to me, like, when he lost his job, he said, the political elite decides you're untouchable, and then the corporate world will not want to touch you either. And I mean, that's a real problem, is that people who do speak up end up, you know, being on the outskirts, ostracized, struggling to get jobs. It's not healthy for our society for us to really be so unsupportive of people who have that, make that brave decision to speak out. We have to fundamentally change how we treat people like that, how we protect them, how we support them. Otherwise, things like Steinhoff, things like SARS, things like state capture, all these things are just going to keep happening because we're not enabling people to tell the truth and be protected.
Oof. It's such a fine line. I totally get what you mean. And at the same time, we also need to have a level of objectivity when we're dealing with things like these to make sure that at the end of it, it's constructive and we move on in a better manner.
Completely. And I mean, I think, you know, I think it's important that the state capture witnesses are cross-examined and that, you know, there's discrepancy, if there's discrepancies in what they're saying or the issues that are not correct and whatever, they are cleared up. But I also think that we just need to be careful in terms of our public rhetoric about being nuanced and considerate in our criticism versus attacking and tearing down and branding people as liars or saying that someone would go out and just simply make up evidence about these meetings and whatever. You know, because, yeah, that's what they feel like doing. I think that we have to be very, very acutely conscious of the people who have spoken up, have done it at great cost to themselves.
Yeah.
And that needs to be understood and reflected when we evaluate the evidence.
Just in wrapping up, because I know you're a very busy person, we don't want to keep on for too long though. Do we know, excuse me, do we have any updates on Fakie Mentor? Because I remember as we're talking about, you know, what it means for people to stand up and speak out, last week she said she was fearing for her safety at a point. Has anything else developed from that?
Look, I mean, I know that they did. My understanding was that they said they were going to move her into another hotel, and that happened, and they've sort of looked at her security and her situation. So inquiry took it very seriously, and they have assisted her. I mean, she is going to be back potentially if she faces cross-examination from some of the witnesses. So we should get a greater sense of update as to what happened there when she returns to potentially be cross-examined.
And are we also going to see another appearance of Phumla Williams or Mzwanele Mann?
Well, Phumla is coming back to complete her evidence today after these applications for cross-examination. Mzwanele Mani has been notified that he is an implicated party from her evidence. He obviously there was that unfortunate incident where he basically texted Pumla Williams and said that they wanted her to say certain things about him, the New Age breakfasts happening after his time and whatever.
Yeah.
The inquiry is still investigating that. He's admitted that he did it. I mean, it's rampantly inappropriate to contact a witness while they're giving evidence in a commission. But anyway, they're finalizing a report, and the DCJ Zonda will then make a decision. Money, up until the last, I mean, he may have done it subsequently. Last hearing, he hadn't actually brought an application to cross-examine. He may now do that. And I think there's a very strong likelihood that even if he doesn't choose to cross-examine, he is likely to be summoned as a witness before the inquiry to kind of address some of the allegations raised by Maseko and Pumla Williams.
And then finally, what was the justification behind the inclusion of Daniel Kaufman and Joel Hellman? These are supposedly the two academics who were the ones to coin the term state capture.
I think basically, I mean, they are coming to, you know, give evidence later this month, but I think it was the commission is, you know, we're the first country in the world to actually ever do a commission of inquiry or try to understand state capture as a phenomena. State capture, the term that they cause, is a phenomena in countries like Russia, certain countries in South America, but it's never been the subject of like an actual state-sponsored commission of inquiry. And I think, you know, the issue is what exactly they were asked to address. What exactly is it? Like, how does it operate? How does it work? When we say state capture, what do we actually mean? So in terms of that, they were brought in and they were asked to sort of address certain hallmarks of how the machinery of state capture worked in terms of how do you, you know, with state owned enterprises or government, how are the mechanics of this achieved? So that was why they were brought in. I mean, they have not studied South Africa specifically. They're talking in broad senses and really looking, you know, they did a lot of work in Russia and some of the South American countries.
Okay.
I mean, I think it was just kind of more trying to, I think, encapsulate in an academic way what exactly state capture is. So I think that was why they were brought in. And I think that the inquiry is going to bring similar experts in to give evidence throughout the hearings.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, for coming on this morning. Thank you for your perspective and also just breaking down some of these things that just go way over our heads. But to now understand the inquiry a bit better and the processes that are going on there.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for stopping by. We'll chat to you sometime soon.
Cool, man. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye. We'll see. She helped us out there.
How does she know so much? It's unbelievable.
I really do marvel at journalists as much as they get bad reps on this or that or this is said about them. To sit in a room, to concentrate for hours on end.
To become an expert in something that you probably didn't study necessarily or want to become an expert in, and yeah, it's just thrown at you and you deal with it.
You use the word expert, and a couple of weeks ago, Ben actually asked me this question. It was like, what are you an expert in, or what are you good at? I'm like,
jack of all trades.
I don't know.
A little bit of everything.
I'm going to try to be a better person around that.
Yeah. Well, what does it mean to be a man in today's world? There's a lot of confusion about this and a lot of anger directed at men. This is a conversation about masculinity everyone needs to hear. In this raw and authentic series of 6 podcasts, Craig Wilkinson and Khalil Osiris start from the premise that true masculinity is a great gift to the world. Equally relevant to men and women, it provides profound insights into why men behave the way they do. It unpacks the 3 core desires at the heart of every man, the question every boy needs answered on his journey to manhood, the 4 big lies about masculinity, what wounds the masculine heart, and the one thing every man wants from women more than sex. Man to Man Talks is brought to you by Carling Black Label. Drink responsibly, not for sale to persons under the age of 18. Available now on the cliffcentral.com website.
Making a note of that. Thank you, Leanne. To some messages this morning. Well, Daniel K says, "Hey guys, please."
Who was that? Gaithly. I haven't seen that person here today.
How would you even begin to spell that name?
No.
Daniel K. rather says, "Hey guys, please can you create a Podlet set on all the Alpha Code stuff? Wanted to share with a colleague and found it tough to find as the search only brings up the full podcast." Well, Daniel, you can... don't exactly know specifically what Podlet you're asking for, but you can just go onto cliffcentral.com. There's a whole Alpha Code page, and that has the details of the competition, also has the entry forms, and then also breaks it down into more details as to like what you'd get in the program, you know, all encompassing and. So for more information on Alpha Code, you can go into cliffcentral.com. You do have one more day to enter because applications close on the 7th of September, as we've realized how the calendar works this morning.
Yeah, and that, it's not the 9th today, it's right. The 6th.
Exactly. And then Tabo says, "Sia, you pick the music from now on. These kind of songs make me want to go to work."
Oh, look at that. Sia, the DJ.
No, well, I just don't understand what sort of music makes you want to go to work.
Yeah, I mean.
We must have done something right this morning if you actually want to wake up, have a spring in your step and want to go to work. But okay, so let's hopefully get it right with another song just quickly. And then straight after that, we'll be touching base with more news stories. Yeah, with Leanne and myself and Nola. We're just chinchilling this morning.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening live, well, a little earlier we were chatting to Karen Morn for the Burning Platform, and we were chatting all things related to the state capture inquiry. But this is, I just find it so fascinating when we look at things in hindsight. This is a clip from an interview Batabile Dlamini did a while ago. And listen to this, and I just think, didn't she technically warn us about the situation we're currently in?
All of us there in the NEC have our smaller nyana skeletons, and we don't want to take out all skeletons out because there will be, or hell will break loose.
Sure. What?
Yeah.
I saw this the other day. I'm like, maybe we shouldn't dismiss people just as like
absolutely
random drunks. And sometimes they're hinting at something.
Yeah.
But as well, it's not rocket science. We know how politics is in this country. We know that there are shady things going on. But yeah, Batabile was trying to warn us, but we didn't listen, I guess. It's a mess. Anyway, do you want to focus on other things apart from politics this morning?
Yeah, I think we've had a lot of politics today.
Yeah. What's in the news today?
Well, you know the 10,000 daily goal of steps.
Yes, the whole fitness thing.
That's all been brought into question now.
Okay, because firstly, do you follow that?
I don't think I've ever reached 10,000 steps. I mean, you really put me on the spot. I should have guessed that you would have asked me that.
No, I just think it's a fair question.
I don't know. It kind of ranges between 3,000 and 5,000 or something like that. Okay. Unless I consciously exercise, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm the type of person who'll park outside the Topsit Spa and then move my car to the stairs.
I thought I was the only one who does that.
Oh no, I literally do that, and then I'll drive two parking spots down to the ATM, and then, you know, the car guard's like, "Bye." No, I'm not going yet.
These shopping complexes get too wide, or if different stores that you need to go to are on different levels, I'm like,
yeah, exactly.
Don't feel like the walks. Well, I'll drive around.
Don't feel too bad, because a lot of people are grappling with this idea of 10,000 daily steps as a goal.
Okay.
It's become really entrenched in popular culture. All of our devices measure 10,000 steps. It's, you know, any wearable device that you wear or use has this goal.
Yeah.
And it's apparently a completely arbitrary figure. It originated from a successful Japanese marketing campaign in the mid-60s. in an attempt to capitalize on the immense popularity of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, the company Yamasa designed the world's first wearable step counter, a device called a Manpo K, which translates as 10,000 step meter. So there really wasn't any evidence for it at the time. They just felt that it was a number that was indicative of an active lifestyle and should be really healthy. So a team at Kyushu University of Health and Welfare began to investigate the potential benefits of taking 10,000 steps. They concluded that the average Japanese person took between 3,500 and 5,000 steps a day. That's exactly where I lie. And that if these people increased their daily step count to 10,000, they would decrease their risk of coronary artery disease. So they wore this little device. It looked almost like a fob.
A fob?
Like a watch. You know, those watches that you...
Fitbit, no.
No, those watches that from the olden days that you'd like wear in your pocket
the
with a chain.
With the chains, oh, okay.
That's a fob.
Is it really called a fob? Yeah. F-O-B.
Yes.
Is it called like a pocket watch?
Well, maybe. Maybe I just dreamt up this word. I don't know. You know.
Okay, it's called a fob. Yeah.
So they never really tested the 10,000 steps a day thing. They also didn't test 8,000. They also didn't test 12,000. So it was totally made up.
People are just trying to make us suffer here out of nothing.
Yeah. You know, We know that sedentary lifestyles are bad, and if you're taking fewer than 5,000 steps a day on average, this can lead to weight gain, increase your risk of bone loss, muscle atrophy, becoming diabetic, and a whole lot of issues. But at the same time, there seems to be an obsession about 10,000 and how many steps are enough. Yet what they're saying now, what's more important is that we just get off the couch, because sometimes this 10,000 step thing makes the goal's too high, and it makes you realize that you're not going to achieve it, so you just don't even try 3,000.
So they're already saying less than 5,000 steps is not necessarily a concern, but it's not ideal.
Not ideal, yeah.
I'm looking at my app now. Yeah. Over the past couple of days, I've averaged 2,000 and something steps.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's like low 2,100, 2,300.
Oh, jeez. Well, I think maybe we should stop driving our cars to the different shops in the same centre.
Let's start with that. It's very easy.
Or we could become Amish, because scientists have studied the Amish people in rural Canada. Obviously, they use no motorised forms of transport. They average 14,000 to 18,000 a day.
Nah, I know how I feel about
too much.
That. No, thank you. So here's the thing. I'm actually proud of yesterday. I did 9,996 steps.
What did you do?
It now annoys me that I was 4 steps away from 10,000. Oh. But I was filming something, a project that I'm working on, and we were walking around town with this crew. And so walking all over the place, but halfway through the shoot, not even halfway through, after like an hour filming, I was like, I think I'm done with this. And we were in Sandton, so I started hiring a tuk-tuk. Which once again speaks to how lazy I am. I was like, no, I don't feel like walking around Sandton. How about we hire a tuk-tuk?
No, look, you almost reached your goal, so...
Yeah, but
it's a good thing.
All of these surveys and what this one says and what this doctor will say, and then a new professor comes up with this study, I think you just need to take it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
Not literal salt if you have high blood pressure.
Yeah. And yeah, just, you know, if the goal can be daunting, and going from nothing to doing 10,000 steps a day can have adverse effects as well.
Yeah.
And this is what the study is also showing. So maybe just start small and forget about the 10,000 goal for now.
Yeah. You know, Leanne, you gave great advice. We should start off by simply just walking around the shopping complex.
Between the bottle store and the fast food outlet.
That's an easy thing I can start to implement in my life.
Oh, gosh. We'll get there.
Lubabalo on Telegram says, "Ooh, Leanne, you sound so sexy."
Oh, goodness.
In my mind, that's how Lubabalo sounds. It's probably way off, but... And even
you might be like, "You sound so sexy."
Go give him some, you know, give him some credit. Yeah, he even put like a little emoji with heart eyes on it. So yeah, guess it counts for something. If we're sticking with love and romance, look at how much I'm trying to make a segue from Lubabalo's message to the next story. But I always bring up on the show how much of a cornball I am because I love tacky, just crazy television.
Oh, yes.
Because just give me...
Speaking of taking no steps.
That's what happens. That's why I don't take steps. Give me a tacky reality show and I'm glued and I watch. Because not to make myself sound profound, but I think it actually... Reality shows are indicative of the times that we live in. They really are a mirror of to ourselves, and they're a slice of society, and they show us where we are.
Yeah, a lot of these shows are used by psychologists and sociologists to figure out what's going on in our lives these days.
Yeah.
And how we navigate life.
You look at how if you went back 50 years ago and the slapstick type of American TV, for example, we'd watch is, you know, there'd be a music variety show on a Saturday night and it would be someone who'd end off with a bye-bye now, God bless America. You know, that was just the state of the times. And there would be, you know, you moved into the 80s and that was the quintessential nuclear family who's all happy and they're dealing with their, you know, suburban life. And now you get people who throw bottles at each other. Well, I still just think it's a prime example and showing us what society is like. So which brings me now to The Bachelor. Of course, we know The Bachelor is...
Love it.
Do you watch it?
I do.
And why
and The Bachelorette. I'm a romantic at heart, even though I've been burned... I mean, I've really had my ups and downs, but I still believe in romance, and I think it stems from fairy tale stories growing up as a little girl, and yeah, I just think, I mean, I know that a lot of it's bullshit, and, and a lot of stuff doesn't really, we don't see all of it on screen, but yeah, I just quite enjoy the romantic aspect of it.
Well, we might be biased in this room then, I guess, because I always say that is why The Bachelor has been on for seasons on end, and that is why though it would not work if it was not filmed in a mansion and it wasn't a bachelor or bachelorette who was gorgeous and wasn't people who were all fit and tanned,
lots of sparkling dresses and suits,
exactly, and have a makeup team on their beck and call. If it was just, you know, Tom, Dick and Jablani who were stuck in traffic the entire morning and then we had to film that, you know, it wouldn't exactly work, but it's that fantasy appeal of it that makes it work. And so I marvel at how these television producers work, because now a new Bachelor has been chosen. This is for the 23rd season of The Bachelor in the United States, and they have announced a guy by the name of Colton Underwood as the new Bachelor. He's 26 years old. He's a former NFL star, which means he played football in the States. So right now, all good and well about this. And, you know, if you Google him, he looks very well put together. So it ticks all the little check the boxes in what people look for in a Bachelor. But now here's a plot twist.
Yeah.
Colton is a virgin.
Oh, goodness.
And I don't know whether that's a yay or a nay for people.
We've had on the Bachelor before, we've had virgin potential bachelorettes, but never the star of the show.
There
was one woman who's a virgin or was a virgin, but I've never come across this. This must be the first.
Look, I know the TV producers are loving all of this. They are loving the fact that this is just going to create a stir. This is great ratings for them, because I might sound very simple or I might just sound very crass, but I'm very interested to see how this all plays out.
Yeah.
Because my thing is, there are levels to what sort of virgin you are.
Oh, yes.
Like, what have you done? Have you gone, you know, just a quarter of the way? Have you fooled around? Or evidently then you haven't done anything at all. And so how does that factor into how you deal with someone who you're attracted to?
Yeah.
And for a lot of us who well, I might not say a lot of us, for some of us who sex might not be the most important thing ever, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what sort of things he has done and hasn't done.
Yeah.
The fantasy suite's going to be a little bit different, I suppose.
Yeah, what do? Do you just sit there? Stare into each other's eyes?
Maybe he'll find the one. And, I mean, there's also... We need to figure out why his aversion. Is it for religious reasons?
Reasons.
I'm just going to have some water.
For me personally, if I encountered that, I wouldn't find that appealing.
Really?
Yeah. If the plot is for us to end up getting married forever and ever, amen, and you're a virgin, I don't want that.
Mm.
You don't know what you're doing. That's
yeah, like, or you might end up with someone who thinks for the rest of their life, I'm only ever going to have sex with one person.
Nope, not interested in that. Or yeah. They might think they are amazing at what they're doing. Meanwhile, they, once again, I'm sounding crass, they get on top of you, they're huffing 2 seconds and they're done. I'm like, no, that's not the bar. I think experience is the best teacher. We all need we need experience in our lives.
Yeah. No, I think I would have an issue with it too, but I think for him, you know, he's not the only virgin around, and male virgin who's in his 20s. And I'm just reading a quote from him. He said, "Being a virgin needs to be normalized. It's just who I am and what I believe in. I hold a lot of value in it, and I hold it to a high standard. I'm just waiting for the right heart."
I don't even find that sweet. I'm just like, you need to dip it, you need to do it, you need to know what you're getting into when we're ready.
Also, he may be pinning his hopes on something that's not that great anyway, you know?
So is it only weird when it's a guy or not a girl?
It is kind of weird that it's a guy, which is why this sort of thing's important for us to challenge our minds and see that it's completely normal.
See, for me, it's not about the gender that's weird. For me, it's the age. You're late 20s and you're still a virgin. And I understand it. I'm totally being subjective with this. It's just my personal bias. But in my head, I think I would encourage that you get it over and done with in your odd late teen years or early 20s, and it's just that awkward experience, and then you'll get into knowing yourself and also see, I'm no doctor, but sexuality as a journey. And so to get comfortable in your own body, what you like, what you don't like, some would argue that you can explore that with one person regardless of your age and regardless of where you are in life. But
look, I'll tell you one thing. I wouldn't want to be the person to break his virginity. There's just too much responsibility. Hey?
The attachment.
He's
there.
Waited 26 years for this. And I mean, he's got these expectations. It would be far too much.
Is that why it would be off-putting to you?
I would never do that. Yeah, I've just made my decision.
You would never put yourself through something like
that. No, it's too much pressure.
No, what would be, is it a yay or nay for you? Do you find that appealing? Do you find that off-putting? Or do you find it not even a thing?
Look, I don't know. I don't want to be someone's teacher and now having to, no.
Yeah.
Let's vibe together. Let's be on the same level and experience. I think it's nice and all. I think it's cute. But for me personally, I wouldn't want to pop a virgin.
No. I don't even find it cute. Yeah, it's my own perspective. But at the same time, in terms of being fascinated by this, I really am. I do want to see how he's going to go into the fantasy suite. How much experience does he have? Is he a good kisser? Will now those iconic scenes at the end of the show look like someone is being taken through a washing machine with it? Like, I really am drawn to that.
Uh-huh. I was a virgin up until 19, and a lot of my peers at the time thought that was really odd. And it was not for religious, you know, reasons. Yeah. I just wasn't ready. But I did a lot of reading At the time, I think I finished the entire series of Mills and Boone.
Oh, yeah. And so you were getting experience of some kind.
You know what I mean? I knew exactly what to expect, and although it is fiction, but not so much. Mm. And I wasn't totally clueless, you know. But for a guy, yeah.
Not for you. Mm. But I don't think 19 is something to walk over.
Look, you know these times that we live in, these girls and these young kids, really, at 13, 14, they've already done it. So
I guess that's so worrying.
It's the oddest thing ever.
Good luck to anyone raising kids. Good luck to anyone raising kids. Anyway, I just thought I should bring that up this morning. The next bachelor being a virgin.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
So, yeah, we spoke a little bit earlier about Pet Haven and Pause for Thought, which is a podcast that a podcast series that I've been doing, which has been really fun. And something that, I mean, I've obviously researched a lot on animals, and it really does interest me. And something that I'd never known about was a new sport, fairly new, which is called nose work. And it's a new sport in which dogs seek out specific scents. It's also an opportunity to let dogs do what they do best, obviously. A lot of animals, or a lot of dogs, are bred specifically for picking up scents and being used in police training and drug detection and all of that sort of thing. And if they don't actually fulfill this role, they become frustrated, their behavior becomes altered, they become sort of stir crazy, and they don't really have a duty to perform every day. Mm. So we were looking at like high energy working dogs like retrievers, etc. They need to be mentally and physically stimulated, and they require a regular routine like retrieving ducks or like search and rescue.
Yeah.
And a lot of these dogs are seen as behaving undesirably and they're given harsh training methods, when all that it really takes is for them to do a little bit of nose work. So, as I said, a relatively new dog sport. It mimics the types of tasks performed by drug detection or search and rescue dogs. So in various indoor and outdoor venues, nose work dogs sniff out Q-tips or earbuds that have been infused with essential oils like birch, anise, clove or cypress. Then during competition, it actually gets to that level, dog handler teams scan a designated area for a certain amount of odors in a predetermined amount of time. Dogs then communicate to their handlers that they've located a hide. They pause with their nose on the scent until the handler calls the word alert. So it all sounds very professional and that sort of thing, but they say that you can bring this into your home and do it with your dog. So it might be interesting to see. I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to put some Q-tips into different things. That doesn't sound good. Different scents and oils, leave them around, and that could keep my dog busy. You know, he's so active, and he drives me nuts half the time.
What sort of dog do you have?
A miniature pincher.
Yeah, so they do need to be stimulated.
Doing something.
Yeah.
Every time I sit up in bed, or if I move slightly on the sofa, he gets up and runs. And
oh no, he's like, okay, she's awake.
Yeah.
Does he ever wake you up?
Oh yeah, all the time. So yeah, I think it might be interesting to see, you know, they pick up the scent from far away, and then he makes a game of trying to find it.
This just further proves just how smart animals are.
Yeah, and how much stimulation they need, really.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
Mm.
And it will also, if we start partaking in things like this, it will help us get to our 10,000 steps, or rather just over 5,000. That's what we need, right?
Or we'll just put our wearable device on our dog.
And they can track it on our behalf.
Yeah.
Goodness, it's already 7:55, which means we're about to wrap the hour up. That's our Thursday edition of the show, Done and Dusted. But before we just close off the show, I found this out and I just wanted to read it. It was from the Times. It's quite an old viewpoint, actually, because this clip from the Times started being shared a lot just last month. But this is the thing. I saw this on social media, and it is around how tech billionaires are parenting their own kids. So I'm going to just read it directly because I just find it so interesting in and of itself. So this is what they say. For example, Melinda Gates, right? We know her. She's the wife of Bill Gates, the billionaire. Melinda Gates' children with Bill don't have smartphones and they only use a computer in the kitchen. Her husband, Bill, on the other hand, spends hours in his office, not as we'd think on a computer, but rather every day he makes a point to read books while everyone else, the rest of us, we're at home refreshing our homepages. And the most sought after private school in Silicon Valley, it's called the Waldorf School of the Peninsula. They actually, and you'd presume that this is where all of these tech billionaires' kids go, that school bans electronic devices for the under 11s. And so the likes of the children of the heads at eBay or Apple or Uber or Google, they instead are taught to make go-karts, knit, and to cook.
Wow.
Isn't that something? Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook wants his daughters to read Dr. Seuss and play outside rather than use the likes of Messenger for kids. Steve Jobs, from Apple, strictly limited his children's use of technology at home. So this article concludes, this is Alice Thompson from The Times. She concludes by saying, it's astonishing if you think about it. The more money you make out of tech industry, the more you appear to shield your family from its effects.
So they're the ones who've developed all of this technology.
And more so, they're the ones who now realize what it's doing to us as a culture.
Yes.
I read that. And as you start to let it sink in, you realize that actually, what are we doing? We aren't saying that technology is bad and technology is here to help us. But shouldn't we also be learning from why these tech heads would be limiting their kids, their own kids, to this?
It's the total opposite to what you would have expected.
Mm.
Because it's safe to say that we have allowed technology to sort of take over our lives and rule us in a way.
I find it so ironic. But anyway, I think that's a good point to end things off on this morning. And I just wanted to let that be our last word. Well, that's it.
That's it for Thursday.
Yes. Thank you so much, Leanne. Popped in not just once, but twice this morning.
Yes. Well this week.
Hope it was fun for you. Nolo, thank you for coming in as well. And also thank you for listening. So we had some messages in this morning. We had a compliment for Leanne.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
I nearly exaggerated the fact, but let's just stick to the realities. It was a good compliment. And we have a whole lineup this morning on Cliff Central and the rest of the afternoon. It's a Thursday, so there's Future CEOs, there's the Unview. There's so much going on. And if you miss out on any of that, you can always go into cliffcentral.com to catch up on any podcast. And for the show in the next hour, usually we have new interviews every Thursday and every Tuesdays and Thursdays. But tomorrow, rather, we'll be airing a new interview. So this morning is another replay. And let me just drop this in there for you. Tomorrow, we've specifically scheduled this new interview for tomorrow instead of today because there are some regulations around it. Let me just...
Interesting.
Let me just leave it at that.
And mysterious.
We were just told to specifically schedule it for the 7th because of some things that surround it. So might be a bit juicy. Might be an exclusive. Might be something else that we need to know, but I'll leave it at that. Until tomorrow.
CliffCentral.com.